chapter 1, verse 2 and 3. I will utterly, I've translated it as literally as I can because I think there's reasons it'll help be helpful by doing that. When you're translating from Hebrew into English, of course you've got to make it try and get it sounding like English. But as you know, a translation is always an interpretation. Now, I'm doing it too. So I'm trying to get back to the actual original words often, and it's not good English, and you couldn't put in a Bible and make sense of it without a teacher. But the word they use there is the word there, I've got the Hebrew for you, asap, and it means to harvest. Now, it can be positive or negative. But so I will utterly harvest. Now, asip, the noun, was the earliest name given to the gathering in the autumn of the fruits of the harvest. So it was a harvest time. It was booths that became, later it was called Sukkot, or booths, or tabernacles. They're all the different names for this important New Year festival at the time of the year. Well, the winter's come to an end. They're harvesting the fruits of the autumn fruit, and then they're waiting for the autumn rains to come so they can sow their wheat and their barley and the rest of their stuff. So God is this speaking, this is through Zephaniah, he's going to harvest something. Well, it really means to strip bare. It's a negative word here. Like you strip the trees of all their fruit. Well, he's going to strip. I will harvest everything from the face of the earth, says Yahweh. This might remind you, I'm reminding you anyhow, of the Genesis story of the flood. And why God, inverted commas, determined to wipe out creation. I will harvest humans and animals. I'll harvest, I'll get rid of, I'll empty out the birds of the air, the fish of the sea, and those who cause the wicked to stumble. I will cut off humanity from the face of the earth, says Yahweh. So he sees Yahweh, because he's feeling like this, has been very angry with the mess that's going on in Judah at the time and with the resistance possibly to the king's desire to have a reform and to the sin and injustice, and you can have to fill in the gap yourself. So he's saying it's so bad, God's going to, the same as the flood. Here's the flood story. Genesis chapter 6, verse 7, Yahweh said, I will blot out from the earth the human beings I've created, people together with animals and creeping things and birds of the air, for I'm sorry that I made them. And that's the feeling of the writer of the book of Genesis. God regretted that he'd made humanity because of, I gave it to you 2 weeks ago, I think, Hamas, violence. The violence that's going on in the world is such that he thinks God is thinking, oh dear, look, I shouldn't have ever done it. Human beings are so poor. They're so resistant to life and love and justice that, well, let's wipe it out. Let us put an end to it. And unfortunately, in the story, Noah was there. And God is just, and you can't. Noah was innocent. Noah was a just man. One just man is enough to keep it going. So one just person in Canberra will keep the whole show going. So be that one just person that God thought, oh, all right, okay, I'll keep loving you lot, but you better do something about it. All right. Here's Genesis chapter 4, 7. In 7 days I will send rain on the earth for 40 days and 40 nights, and every living thing that I have made I will blot out from the face of the earth. Do you get the parallel? So things are as bad. It's mythical language. It's not factual. The flood didn't happen. I mean, the flood's all over the place. So floods happened, but the flood of the Bible didn't happen, because the flood of the Bible is actually existential flood. It's the reversal of creation. It's a cosmic flood, you know. I mean, the waters rise above the highest mountains in the world and everything's destroyed. Well, if water rose above Mount Everest, the earth would have spun out of control a long time ago. So it's not, do you see what I'm trying to say? It's the flood is the image for the self-destruction that sin can bring about, but justice, truth, love can always make an entry for God. So there's our opening words of Zephaniah. I will stretch out my hand against Judah against all the inhabitants of Jerusalem. I will cut off from this place every remnant of Baal. So they've still got statues to the Canaanite god. And the name of the idolatrous priests, those who bow down on the roofs to the hosts of heaven. Well, this pagan religion stuff. Those who bow down and swear to Yahweh, but also swear by their king. Those who've turned back from following Yahweh and have not sought Yahweh or inquired of him. Be silent before the Lord Yahweh, says Zephaniah. So everyone's allowed to be, no one's allowed to talk except Zephaniah. Does that remind you of anything that's happening now? Anyhow, so be silent, he says. So he's really sure of himself. For the day of Yahweh is at hand. Now, we have done this before. Don't expect you to remember, but you might, back in Amos, the first prophet. The day of Yahweh was always looked upon by people as a great day. He's their God. Yahweh is our God. God will come and get rid of the Romans, come back to the time of Jesus, you know. He'll get rid of the enemies and he'll show where his special people and everything will be fine when the day of the Yahweh comes. Amos was the first to cut across that 150 years before Zephaniah and say, and I'm reading Amos here, why do you want the day of Yahweh? Why are you always saying when the Lord comes? It's darkness, says Amos, it's not light. As if someone fled from a lion and was met by a bear. Or went into a house and rested his hand against the wall and was bitten by a snake. You've gone home to be safe, but you're not. Is not the day of Yahweh darkness, not light, gloom, with no brightness in it? That was a kind of a shocking, heretical thing to say by Amos. But here's Zephaniah giving it another burl. Be silent before the Lord Yahweh, for the day of Yahweh is at hand, the day when the truth will out, and justice will prevail, and evil will be destroyed, etc., etc. At that time I will search Jerusalem with lamps. I will punish the people who rest complacently on their dregs. Those who say in their hearts, Yahweh won't do good. He won't do harm. God's a bit irrelevant, really. I believe in God, yeah, but, you know, we say the creed, but it's irrelevant. He's not going to do any harm, not going to do any good. It's just a buy thing, you know, so it's irrelevant. Their wealth shall be plundered, their houses laid waste. Though they build houses, they will not inhabit them. Though they plant vineyards, they will not drink wine from them. The great day of Yahweh is near. Near and hastening fast. He's trying to get the people to smarten up and change their way of life. The sound of the day of Yahweh is bitter. The warrior cries aloud there. And this is interest those of you who are Latin scholars or nice little girls and boys that used to go to the liturgy in the old days. Dies ira, dies ila. That's where it comes from. That will be a day of wrath. That day, dies ila, will be a dies ira, a day of anger, taken from there and in that hymn. A day of distress and anguish, a day of ruin and devastation, a day of darkness and gloom, a day of clouds and thick darkness, a day of trumpet blast and battle cry against the fortified cities and against the lofty battlements. Not a lot of light at the moment, pretty gloomy, some of you have pointed out, but it's all trying to wake people up, like us, to get on with life and seek first the kingdom of God. You with me? You know, they're not the only ones who need to hear some of this. Excuse me. Seek Yahweh, all you. Now he's using this word anawim, which we met a lot in Hosea and Amos. These are the poor, the downtrodden, the left behind, the people who have no regard, the people who don't have a position in society, the people who are uneducated and you shouldn't listen to them. Well, these are the poor of the land, the oppressed of the land. Seek Yahweh, you people who you who carry out his command, they're living properly. Seek righteousness, and we did that word before, right wiseness. Be wise as to what is right. Seek that. Seek, now they translated humility, I left it there, but humility is a word that's one of the interesting things I found out some years ago is even the Greek word for humility was first used by Paul in his letters. There's no, I was unable to discover, and I exhausted my learning on this, unable to discover tapenophrosune, which is the Greek for humility, anywhere in Greek literature prior to Paul of Tarsus. I think humility is the only virtue that is unique to Jesus and introduced by him. Now, there are things like it, but humility, which means thinking of yourself as small, thinking of yourself as dependent, thinking of our Father who art in heaven, you know, thinking of yourself as not the source of everything or the source of your own good or whatever it is, but realizing that everything you have is gift. Well, Jesus was beautiful at that, and it was kind of, because the word, I'm sorry to distract you from the Hebrew, but it's not unrelated, the word tapenophrosune was used in the first century by two other authors, Epictetus, I think was one, and Josephus. And in both their cases, it was a vice. Because the Greek virtue is to, you know, be yourself, stand for who you are, stand up, be a man, if I could use the male language. But to think of yourself as being lowly was absolutely un-Greek and not worthy of anyone who, and in fact today we might be in the same similar laws. So here I don't think humility is a good word. The Hebrew is anawa, which is related obviously to anawim. So seek righteousness. Seek, well, it's something like seek what you have when you realize that everything you have depends on God. I'd have to use a whole sentence to almost get the meaning of the word there. I've called it reliance on God. Perhaps you may be hidden on the day of Yahweh's wrath. God is angry with the people around the place. We'll see them named in a minute. But the poor, ordinary people who are doing their best to be honest and really saying, look, seek all this, and maybe when God's anger comes and the city's wiped out and all that, you'll be okay because God will overlook you and you'll be in a little corner on your own and you'll come through. Something like that. Then comes in chapter 2, and I won't read it for you. You can read it for yourself. Oh, excuse me. An oracle against Philistia. Things are going bad in Philistia, obviously, from those verses of chapter 2. And what Egypt is doing in Philistia should be a warning to Judah. So he sees this as God coming in. Just as he's destroying Philistia, just as on the coast there, he'll soon be destroying you. Then there's an oracle against Moab and Ammon. Moab is this area here. Ammon is there, so it's surrounding Judah. Yahweh will bring down all the gods of the earth, he says at the end of that little section. And to him shall bow down each in its place, all the coasts and islands of the nations. And he then concludes that section with an oracle against Cush, which is that unknown area south of Egypt. Some say it's Ethiopia, some say it's Sudan. But in their days, no one went that far. So it's beyond the pale. No, that's not the right word. So as far south as everybody knew about in the dim, dark desert back there. And Assyria is as far as anyone knew anything up this way either. So from extreme south to extreme north, oracles are spoken against. So it's not just Judah, it's all these nations. But Judah is going to get caught up in it, brackets, unless they reform. You better get unless they change their way.